Welcome to Geopolitical Horizons, the podcast from thegeopolity.com. We want to continue with our series looking at the geopolitics of the different regions of the world. We've had a look at Europe, Africa, the Middle East, and the Far East so far. Today, we want to look at Central Asia. And like always, I have Geopolity founder Adnan Khan with me to analyze Central Asia. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm doing well, Yusuf. How's it going on your side?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I mean, when we think about Central Asia, I feel like it's a part of the world which is quite unknown. Even myself, I can't think of anything that really stands out to me about Central Asia. So let's begin where we always do. What are the key features of this region?
Central Asia probably flies below the radar purely because, I mean, it's quite far away from the West. What you find also is it's not really in the middle of struggle between different nations. And also for a long period of time, it was behind the Iron Curtain. It was under the Soviet Union, Central Asia. So for at least the last 75 years, Central Asia was domestic Soviet policy. So what you find is that it never really saw political struggle between different powers. So what is the region? I think that's probably a good place to start. So the region we're talking about, Central Asia, it stretches from the Caspian Sea in the west. If we go around to the north, you get the deserts where Kazakhstan meets Russia. If we go to the east, you got two mountain ranges, the Tian Shan Mountains and the Altai Mountains. And these mountains separate Central Asia from China and Afghanistan. And then to the south of Central Asia, you've got the northern mountains where Afghanistan is. So really, Yusuf, if we go from the north to the south of Central Asia, you've got Kazakhstan in the north, which is largely desert. And as you go to the south, you've got a number of countries there today. So you have Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, which are mostly flatland. And then next to them, you have Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, which are actually in the mountains. So probably one of the key features of this region, Yusuf, is 60% of the region is desert. And in the desert, you don't really get water. So water resources is a key struggle or feature in this particular region. What makes this region important is how it's connected to other very important regions. So Central Asia is connected to South Asia via Afghanistan. Central Asia is connected to Russia. And actually, Central Asia, for a lot of history, was considered the underbelly of Russia. It's connected to the Caspian. The Caspian is a very important sea, which has significant energy resources. And it's also connected to China. So these things taken together, they make the region really important.
If I think about Central Asia, I always think about the Silk Road. So there was a lot of trade routes through that. Is that where most of its history was?
Yes. The Silk Road, which starts from China, goes across Central Asia and comes to the Middle East and goes to Europe. That is probably a key thing that shaped the region. You've also had many Turkic empires that have risen and fallen over the centuries. So what we have in Turkey today, the people of Turkey in origin were Turkic people who came from Central Asia. You've got Islam played a very key role in the region and still plays a key role today. You've obviously got the Mongols. The Mongols emerged from Mongolia, China. And Central Asia, they always had to pass through Central Asia to get to any part of the world. The region, as I mentioned, was the underbelly of Russia. So the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union after it, they've had a very important role to play in this particular region. And then really since 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union, you've had the emergence of independent nations. And these are the five nations that we have today. So the Turkic empires, Yusuf, 6th to 11th century, this was the history of the region. You had various Turkic tribes that rose and fell. And then by the 9th century, one of the tribal leaders in the region, he became Muslim. And as a result, Islam spread. And by the 15th century, most of the region was Muslim and under Islamic rule. In the 13th century, the Mongols took over almost all of Central Asia. And their rule in the form of various independent khanates, as they called it, it really lasted until at least the 15th century. Really, what you find is by the 1500s, most of the Mongol presence in Central Asia, it had fallen back to the local people, indigenous people of the region. And from that point onwards, probably the next most important thing was the rise of the Russian Empire. Russia, it conquered the region. It began in the 17th century. And really, after 1917, when the Bolsheviks came to power, the Central Asia was integrated into the Soviet system. So the borders we have today are largely the result of Soviet planners who drew the borders that we have today. And probably the final key thing that shaped the region was in 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed and 15 new republics emerged. And five of these were the Muslim majority nations in Central Asia. So in many ways, although you could argue Central Asia is on the periphery of the global system, what you find though, the rise and fall of different empires, the throughway, Central Asia has actually been quite an important region in the world, although it doesn't really get a lot of mention in history, and it doesn't really get much coverage when it comes to the news in the modern day. Nevertheless, you look at China, you look at Russia, you look at America, they do see this region as very important.
The Soviet Union seems to come up time and time and again when we're discussing Central Asia. You mentioned that they drew the borders of this region. What role did this region, Central Asia, that is, actually play in the Soviet system? And how important was it to the USSR?
So what the Soviet Union did is, as it expanded and many of the regions and nations around mainland Russia, these republics, they became a buffer zone, but they also became suppliers of critical materials. So you find under Soviet rule, Central Asia actually supplied most of the USSR's cotton, and it was a major supplier of coal and other minerals for industrial use. Central Asia, even today, Yusuf, it has a lot of energy and has a lot of critical materials. Now, what's interesting is, Yusuf, is Central Asia has a lot of energy, but the Soviet Union didn't really develop many of the energy fuels in Central Asia. And the reason why, the Caspian Sea supplied, I think, over 70% of the Soviet Union's energy. And then later on, we find the fuels in Siberia came online. The Soviet Union was quite reluctant to develop energy infrastructure in areas far from mainland Russia, because these were buffer zones. It would have taken a lot of finance and infrastructure and then military to protect them. So as a result, what you find is Central Asia's energy resources only really came online once the Soviet Union collapsed. So you find today even there's still a lot of Soviet area infrastructure. A lot of planning went into Central Asia to make sure Central Asia was a supplier of the Soviet Union. So probably the biggest mark the Soviet Union left is the fact that it drew its borders. Now, in 1936, what Stalin did is he set up a committee to draw the borders. And the whole idea was to draw borders in a way where the region would be divided. So that's why, Yusuf, you find today that 25% of Kazakhstan has ethnic Russians. Ethnic Uzbeks make up about 15% of Kyrgyzstan's population. And these ethnic Uzbeks also make up around 13% of Tajikistan's population. So what Stalin did, he made sure no one ethnicity became a dominant force in any particular area. So the borders we have today are by design. They're completely artificial. And in many ways, you could argue they are the cause of a lot of the problems we have today. And that is largely what the Soviet Union did to the region.
Thinking back to the map, I feel like I also remember there's a lot of enclaves in that area as well.
Yes. What you find, Yusuf, you've got Kazakhstan, which is largely desert. And as you come south, on one side, you've got Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. And then literally on the other side to them, you've got Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. And even within these countries, you've got valleys, you've got geographic features that actually disunite rather than unite. But like most borders in the world, Yusuf, these were politically drawn. They're artificially drawn. They're not based on natural barriers. And you find the same thing here in Central Asia.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union, obviously, you've explained that no one ethnicity were the dominant ethnic group within any country. So did these countries really get independence? Were they kind of marred with loads of problems between different ethnic groups? How did they function?
So Yusuf, for around 60 years, Central Asia was behind the Iron Curtain. Although the Iron Curtain was termed for Europe, really these countries were behind the Soviet border. So they were behind the Iron Curtain. So when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, Moscow lost control of these constituent republics. And obviously Russia went through quite a significant internal chaos in the 1990s. So there's nothing much it could do. We've got to keep in mind that the collapse of the Soviet Union led to the collapse of the Communist Party in Russia as well. But what you find, Yusuf, the heads of the Communist Party in the Republic, they remain the rulers. So in Russia, Gorbachev was the last Soviet leader. And really, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the Communist Party collapsed. So Boris Yeltsin he took over and our new class of people emerged, the Communist Party completely collapsed. This didn't happen in Central Asia. What you find was the communist officials who used to report to Moscow from the Central Asian Republic, they continued being the leaders. So although Eastern Europe, you could argue, became independent, Central Asia really, you had a ruler who should report to Moscow. Now he doesn't report to Moscow. Now he is the actual de facto ruler. So what this meant is for the people, the Soviet system still continued really in the form of the government that they had. The difference now was they had a ruler who didn't report to Moscow. Now he became independent. So what we find in the 1990s is two issues emerged domestically in Central Asia. The first was that the post-Soviet regimes in Central Asia, they had no experience of ruling their territories directly. They used to rule under instruction from Moscow, and Moscow used to send them loads of advisors. We also find use of Central Asia faced immense economic and political challenges, as all the subsidies and the military support that came with being part of the USSR, that collapsed overnight. So this region for 60 odd years was integrated into the Soviet Union. It supplied the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union sent money the other way. That came to a stop. So as a result, what you find was this led to a lot of instability in Central Asia in the 1990s. So immediately Tajikistan descended into a civil war. And what you find is outside groups got involved in this civil war and started taking sides. You find in Uzbekistan, there was a warfare between the different factions. We also find, Yusuf, despite the oppression of the Soviet Union and the republics, Islam really emerged very rapidly after 1991. What you find, Yusuf, is the people's sentiments all came to the surface, which were very, very Islamic. And many of the rulers felt threatened by this. So they're now independent. The people are Muslim, are Islamic, and they want Islam. So what you find is very quickly, Yusuf, all the rulers in the region, they set up secret states in order to monitor their population, and they began to oppress them. So I was actually at university, Yusuf, in the late 1990s. And when you met anyone from Central Asia, very reluctant to talk to you, very reluctant to talk about details of Central Asia, because they came from a police state, effectively, and they weren't used to talking openly. So unfortunately, in order to maintain power, many of the rulers of Central Asia, they resorted to brutal methods of suppression. And in many ways, unfortunately, they were worse than the Soviet era.
1990s is a long time ago, Adnan. Are those countries still like that?
Unfortunately, they are, Yusuf. I think some of these, like Uzbekistan, Islam Karimov only passed away a few years ago. And in some of the other countries like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, you find that the rulers are the children of the original communist members. So unfortunately, yeah, not too much has actually changed.
Okay, so what's the relationship between Russia and Central Asia now? Russia today is very different to where it was three decades ago. So what is its relationship now like with Central Asian countries?
Yeah, so the last three decades, Russia's tried to continue as normal with Central Asia. What Russia tried to do was effectively inherit what the Soviet Union had. However, obviously it had problems. Russia wasn't the Soviet Union. Russia had a lot of domestic issues. So some of the key things Russia did that on the last day of the Soviet Union, I think December 25th, 1991, the Soviet Union was signed out of existence. And what the Soviet Union did with these independent republics, it set up the Commonwealth of Independent Nations, CIS. And this was formed in order to smooth relations between the newly independent states. But what you find is countries like Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and the Baltic states, they never joined this organization. Now, there's no natural border that separates Russia from this region. There's no seas or there's no oceans between them. So it's quite hard for Central Asia to operate independently when you've got no natural barriers. And then what didn't help was most of the leaders of these Central Asian republics, they were just former comrades from the Communist Party. So technically, they were never independent. What Russia also did is it linked the region militarily with Russia by establishing the Collective Treaty Security Organization, CTSO. And this meant that Russia would be the security guarantor. So a bit like NATO does for Europe. This organization was going to provide security. Keep in mind, Yusuf, the military, the Red Army, was all with Moscow. They used to have some bases across Central Asia, but most of them were with Moscow. So these countries had no military they could talk of. They'd just become independent. So Moscow provided them with a military cover. So that's why we find that Russia eventually set up bases in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And this organization, the CSTO, it also included a rapid reaction force, which is dominated by Russia. So if there's ever a coup or something suddenly happens, Russia can intervene. In 2010, a customs union was set up. bit like a European Union of the region, and this became the Eurasian Economic Union in 2015. So this includes Kazakhstan, includes Kyrgyzstan, some of the key countries in the region. So today, Yusuf, what you find is Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, I would say, are vassals of Russia. Turkmenistan is independent and more pro-Western, a bit like Azerbaijan. And Uzbekistan is a bit of a special case. It's had a leader that's quite unstable. So it seems to chop and change. So really, despite everything that happened with Russia after 1991, it's managed to keep quite a lot of influence in this particular region.
Adnan, what's America's view of this region and the Western view in general?
So the US view of Central Asia has been that this region is a good way to contain Russia, and it's a good way, if they could get control over this region, to break up Russia's monopoly over the pipeline and transit routes for Central Asian oil and gas. So this is how the Americans viewed it. The neocons, Yusuf, were very open in the 1990s. They looked at Central Asia, they looked at the energy there, and they were calling Central Asia the next Middle East. Because for them, for too long, Central Asia was behind the Iron Curtain. So after 1991, they saw a fantastic opportunity for the US to interfere in this region. And this is the underbelly of Russia. So the strategy the neocons eventually came up with is they needed to make sure Central Asian energy wasn't integrated into Russia. Now, the problem is Central Asia is landlocked. And how do you get Central Asian energy to the international markets so it's not dependent upon Russia? So what you're going to need to do is build pipelines that are going to have to go south. So they'll have to go through Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan to the oceans. So the American strategy throughout the 1990s was this is how they were going to integrate Central Asia into the global economy. And this is actually what eventually led to the Afghan War, because this couldn't be done because Afghanistan was in civil war throughout the 1990s. Once the Taliban came to power, America believed now they could integrate Central Asian new energy infrastructure through Afghanistan. The Taliban didn't play ball, and that's why by the end of the 1990s, America was talking about regime change in Afghanistan. So the invasion of Afghanistan has a lot to do with getting Central Asian energy to the international market. So I've got a quote here, Yusuf. This is how Colin Powell spoke about the region. He said, "The Caspian and Central Asian region off the Caucasus of Central Asia, as well as West Asia and South Asia, provides many opportunities once linked with transport and communication. However, this will only be possible once we manage to impose security and safety. Pakistan has already studied and is developing seaports, and we will continue building highways in Afghanistan with the help of our partners." So US plans really was about linking Central Asia with South Asia. So, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran. They didn't want to see this region linked with Russia. If it did, they would lose the region. And this region is the next Middle East. That's very important for them. So today, in use of these plans, 3 decades on, they're still taking place. It's been slow. But the main challenge America's had, Yusuf, is Russia just has too much influence. These are former Soviet republics. Russia has significant influence there, and that's been a major obstacle for Russia to penetrate this area. So this is not the Middle East. This is not Africa, which are regions far away from Russia. These are regions which are on Russia's periphery, and Russia just has more influence.
Adnan, I've been reading a lot about China and its involvement in Central Asia, so with the Belt and Road Initiative. How does China see the region, and why doesn't Russia, actually it may do, does Russia see it as encroachment on its own territory by China?
So following the collapse of the Soviet Union, effectively an unexplored frontier opened up for China. Most of the Chinese population is on the eastern coastal area. As you go towards the west, the Xinjiang area, you get mountains, you get desert, and this is effectively a frontier. So for a lot of Chinese history, the border on this frontier has moved a lot. So what Central Asia's offered Beijing is new source of raw materials, new markets, as well as a major transit zone for exports. So the Belt and Road Initiative goes through Central Asia. So as the years have gone on, Central Asia actually become really, really important. So China actually in 2001, it established the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO. And again, this is an organization China set up to integrate Central Asia. So obviously Pakistan, India are part of this, so is Russia as well. So this was China's way to deal with this new frontier. And what you find is China's policy for Central Asia is very economic driven. They look at this as a market. It's a place with a lot of resources, and that's why they're really interested in it. China has poured a lot of money in to develop the region. They realize if you want to link this region with China, you're going to have to build the infrastructure. So in a way, this is what the Soviet Union did. They built infrastructure to link it with Russia. So you find China's building pipelines, roads, rails. All of this is going to traverse the region. They want to bring natural gas, uranium, and other resources from this region to China. So increasingly, what you're seeing, Yusuf, is China is looking at this region from an economic lens, and more it's being integrated into China's Belt and Road Initiative.
How is Russia responding to this?
Okay, so the way Russia's responding, Russia's got some strategic challenges and priorities it has to sort out. This is Central Asia. It's the other side of Russia. When we talk about Russia, we largely talk about Europe. You've got Ukraine going on. This has always been the priority. And the problem Russia has is Russia just doesn't have the economic capability to be dealing with so many fronts. So to some degree, Russia's been quite happy with Chinese investment, Chinese development in this region. When it comes to security and military, that's all been done by Russia. China hasn't got involved in security and these sort of things in the region. China's only really got involved in economics and development and these sort of things. So in many ways, Yusuf, China and Russia don't bump up against each other in Central Asia because they're doing different things. But for the moment, Russia doesn't feel threatened by China's presence. In fact, they feel this is an area they can work together. Russia can't really develop Central Asia. So if China does it, not a problem. And Russia and China seem to be cooperating in Central Asia. They don't see it as an area where they're competing. So as a result, they've been able to work quite well together, Russia. There's not been any tensions. That doesn't mean there won't be tensions. There potentially could be tensions in the future. Russia could see China having... I mean, China doesn't get involved in the politics. It's not trying to remove rulers. It's not trying to back a particular faction. It's prepared to work with whoever's in power. So that's why Russia doesn't feel politically threatened by what China is doing. So I think so long as China doesn't do anything political, I don't think there will be any issues.
Final question for you, Adnan. We always talk about the trends in these regional analysis that we do. So what are the key trends you see in Central Asia going forward?
Well, because the first is water, Yusuf. This region is 60% desert, and there's two main water resources. There's two water systems, which are in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. So they're in the south of the region. But there's other countries that need access to this water. And there's Kazakhstan, which is a massive country that needs access to this water. So tensions over water resources are going to be a big problem. So effectively what you've got is you're in a region where you have little water resources, but the water resources are in another country. So they're going to have to come up with some sort of system where they can share the water resources, and it's already causing a bit of tension between Uzbekistan and the other countries. The second trend is great power competition. America is shifting from the Middle East to the Far East. America is beginning its competition with China. So Central Asia comes into the equation, South Asia comes into the equation now. So once again, like much of its history, Central Asia is going to be caught by competing powers. And the West really haven't penetrated much into Central Asia. So if America's strategy is it wants to make a containment ring around China, it needs to get the countries and regions on its side. So that's something definitely to watch. The third and final trend, Yusuf, is the regional rulers just don't represent the sentiments of the people. So you find there's regular uprisings in this region, there's regular tension in this region, and the rulers resort to brutal methods to try and maintain control. So these three, water resources, great power competition, and the stability with the rulers, these are probably going to be the key trends for watching this region going forward.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com. You can also learn more on many other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.